Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, I'll be talking to a lawyer from the Center for Reproductive Rights about what exactly is going on in Mississippi. An HIV prevention drug is approved by the FDA, but how useful is it? Also, pregnancy testing in bars is just the worst idea. Care2 put out a great video about the relationship between reproductive health and bodily autonomy, featuring a variety of women laying claim to their own bodies.
This is my body. I do what I want with it.
This is my body. I make my own decisions. This is my body. I use it as a canvas. Tattoo it, decorate it, pierce it.
I take medicine if I want to, and only undergo medical procedures I choose.
I eat what I want, exercise for my health, or wear what I like.
I fall in love with whomever, sleep with whomever, and marry whomever I choose.
I decide when and how I become a mother.
This is my body, not yours.
These decisions have nothing to do with you. If I'm not hurting you or stopping you from pursuing your inherent right to happiness, it's none of your business.
In a sense, it's straightforward. But it's so unusual still to hear women stand up and say that we own our own damn bodies. And so it's really moving. I'm a huge fan of technological innovation and of people not contracting HIV, so I really wanted to throw a party when I heard that there was a pill approved by the FDA that you can take to prevent getting HIV. It's called Truvada, and the idea is that you take it every day like a birth control pill, and it helps prevent HIV transmission. But it's not really time to whip out the balloons and noisemakers yet, because the whole thing seems like it has a whole lot of drawbacks that will keep it from really being a player in the war to eradicate HIV. First of all, it's not really like the birth control pill in one major aspect. For a lot of women, the birth control pill is the only safe sex precaution they need because they're in a monogamous, tested relationship. But unfortunately, Truvada really isn't supposed to be used that way.
FDA is stressing that people taking the pill shouldn't feel they're safe.
Truvada alone should not be used to prevent HIV infection.
They should continue to use condoms and limit the number of sexual partners they have.
What struck me as odd about this is that if you use condoms every time you have sex and limit the number of your partners, that's usually enough to prevent getting HIV. Condoms work really well. Research on HIV discordant couples, where one person is infected and the other isn't, has shown that regular condom use works even without a pill as backup. The problem is that people don't use condoms, but it was clear that this is absolutely not supposed to be a substitute for condoms. In fact, so much so that the reason that it got approved was research showed that people who use this drug don't slack off on condom use. Truvada has side effects, and in some people they're very serious, especially with regards to liver stuff. It seems on the surface like the risks way outweigh the benefits of using Truvada plus condoms instead of just using condoms. All that plus, you know, drugs are expensive.
There's another big unknown. In this country, Truvada costs around $13,000 a year. It's not yet clear how many insurers will pay for that.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say probably very few, especially in light of the fact that it's not something that allows for behavioral changes. Since condoms alone are extremely effective, and since insurance companies are often loath to pay for more expensive treatment when the cheaper one is just as effective, I just don't really see it happening, except in rare cases. In fact, I was hard-pressed to think of exactly who could benefit from such a drug, but luckily NPR did another story explaining that aspect. Basically, the first answer is very few people and it's a total niche product. But a few groups of people were discussed.
One group it may be for are committed couples who are what doctors call discordant when it comes to HIV. One partner has it, the other one doesn't. Like James Callahan and Kevin Kirk.
I'm positive he's negative, and I don't really know that we identify that way, but it's just a fact.
Yeah, I know from my end, I've never really put a lot of thought into it.
They live in San Francisco and have been together for more than 5 years. Recently, they sat down with me and talked about whether Kevin, the HIV-negative partner, might want to take Truvada. At first, he was wary of the idea. But 40 minutes into the discussion, he said something that surprised his partner.
That would make you sleep a little better at night.
It would. It would.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
So if say, some reason you won a lottery and you got to take the pill for free for the rest of your life, would you do it just to be safe?
Probably, yeah. No,
For $13,000 a year, it really doesn't seem like a little extra insurance to help you sleep at night is going to be an option for anyone that's not extremely wealthy. Particularly if you're talking about couples like this one, who practice safe sex and the HIV-positive partner takes antiviral drugs that keep his viral load low. I'm not saying that it's not good to be extra safe, but at a certain point, we all do things every day that are riskier than what these two have going on, and I'm a tad skeptical of the value add of an extremely expensive pill. Another group that had a little bit more reason to be interested is women who are in bad relationships with HIV-positive men, where the women are abused and can't insist on a condom every time, and their partners might not be taking their antiviral medications. They interviewed one doctor who had prescribed the drug under those circumstances, but again, I have to wonder about the cost. It just seems like pretty much all women in those situations aren't going to be able to come up with a $13,000 a year. It would be interesting to find out how her patients pay for it. One last situation was mentioned that's of interest.
A special group of heterosexual couples for whom Truvada will be a special boon. Ones where the woman is uninfected, the man has HIV, and they want to conceive a child. Currently, the only safe way to do that is a complicated and expensive process. The man's sperm is treated so it's free of the virus, and then the woman's egg is fertilized in the test tube and implanted in her uterus. Prescribing Truvada for her can avoid all that.
Of course, you're still running a risk of getting HIV in those situations, so I really don't think it's advisable. And imagine most doctors would suggest that keeping HIV out of a woman's system should be prioritized over baby making. Still, it's just part of medicine that you have to accept that some people are going to make their choices. And so I'm glad that there's a way to make what's inherently a risky choice a somewhat safer one. I'd like to welcome Michelle Movahead to the program. Michelle is a staff attorney for the Center for Reproductive Rights, and she has been working tirelessly to help keep the clinic in Mississippi open. The judge finally issued a complex ruling on the case, and Michelle's here to help us understand it. Welcome to RealityCast, Michelle.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with the threat to the clinic itself. What was the regulation passed, and why was it going to shut down the clinic?
Sure. So it's actually kind of a complicated answer. Earlier this year, the Mississippi legislature amended the licensing scheme applicable to abortion facilities by, among other things, requiring all of the physicians associated with an abortion facility to have admitting privileges at a local hospital and staff privileges to replace local hospital on staff physicians, as well as to be a board certified or board eligible OBGYN. So what should have happened under the Mississippi Administrative Procedure Act is that the Department of Health should then have, adopted new regulations to put the statute into effect. And that, all of that would have happened sort of over the course of the summer so that the clinic wouldn't be called on to comply with the new law until mid-August. But then in late June, the Department of Health indicated that they were going to begin enforcing the new requirements right away. So if they had done that, if they had been allowed to do that at that time, you know, the clinic was not going to be able to comply because its doctors don't have privileges at the local hospital, even though the clinic has done everything it possibly could to apply for those privileges. And part of that is just because hospitals take time to process applications. So the department said not only that it was going to expect compliance, but that it was going to refuse to issue the clinic a new license to continue operating after July 1st unless the clinic could demonstrate compliance with the new law. So when we filed the lawsuit, the clinic was facing the certainty that it would have to close its doors on July 2nd because it couldn't comply with the new law. So the judge at that point issued an order that allowed the clinic to keep operating, and the Department of Health then, for some reason, issued the clinic a renewal license so they could keep operating. So the the fight then became about what kind of penalties the clinic would be subject to if the law was allowed to take effect. And as we explained to the court, you know, there are potential criminal penalties, there are potential disciplinary penalties for licensed medical staff at the clinic, and you know, the consequences of forcing the clinic to comply with the law before it had had an opportunity to, you know, even be able to complete the process of trying to comply with the law would really potentially reverberate in ways that no one could control for. So that's what we that's what was before the court, and that's what the judge ruled on earlier this month.
And
No,
it's good because this is like incredibly difficult for us non-lawyers to understand. And so it seemed to me that what the judge ruled was a very like split the baby kind of decision. Can you kind of discuss it?
Sure. So what judges are supposed to do at the beginning of litigation is is preserve the status quo if there's a threat to it. So what the judge's order did is really to put that principle into action. So he looked at the fact that the clinic had already applied for privileges, or the clinic's doctors had already applied for privileges, and he looked at the various assurances the defendants had made. You know, they had said, oh, no, we're not going to prosecute you for anything you do, you know, until later in the game. And, you know, somebody, like they had various officials say, no, we're not going to take certain actions against you yet. And the judge said, okay, so the law can go into effect because the clinic is already trying to apply for privileges, but it's totally unacceptable for the state to do anything to impose a penalty on the clinic for operating while it's not in compliance with the new law. And part of that was because the defendants had made these various promises about not wanting to seek criminal penalties and not wanting to take disciplinary action. They just hadn't sort of done it in a meaningful enough way. So the judge just, you know, took that extra step to make sure that the clinic had the protection it needed in order to continue operating.
So it seems like they're kind of in a limbo state then, right?
That's exactly right. So at this point, what's happening is the law has taken effect, and the Department of Health has gone in and has satisfied itself that, in fact, the clinic's doctors don't have admitting privileges, as they'd been openly saying all along. And so now the clinic is charged with replying to the formal statement of deficiency from the department. And one of the things that the state had said to the judge as we were, when we were before him earlier this month, was that they really thought that the clinic could have a reasonable time to comply with the new law because another section of law specifically says they can have up to 6 months. So now we're waiting to see if they will, in fact, give the clinic a reasonable time to come into compliance. Because at this point, the clinic's ability to comply and, the doctor's ability to comply with the new law is pretty much completely out of their hands. You know, they've done the applications they could, and none of the hospitals have acted.
And is there any reason to believe that the hospitals are not acting? Is there any reason to believe that the hospitals are dragging their feet on this because of the nature of the clinic?
You know, it's always hard to try to guess what's going on in a corporation's mind, right? but certainly in 2006, two of these hospitals had refused to grant privileges to a different doctor who worked at the clinic. And this was under a previous owner, and it was a doctor who no longer works there. But the reason that they had given in denying his application for privileges is that he was an abortion provider. I don't know if that's hospital policy. I don't know if that's the same answer they would give now. I mean, I don't know how much that indicates, if anything. But certainly, I think the fact that here we are towards the end of July, the clinic's doctors put in their applications, well over a month ago. In one case, I think close to 3 months ago, and has heard nothing. I mean, I think that says more.
So I think that brings up the question, and I'm to be very clear, if they can't get those admitting privileges, what happens next?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I think we would have some, you know, I think we would reconsider going back in front of the judge. You know, the judge sort of, in issuing his order, had contemplated the possibility of hospitals, you know, following their procedures and granting privileges and so on and so forth. If, you know, we come to the end of this quote-unquote reasonable time and the clinic's still not in compliance, you know, the Department of Health has said very clearly they will issue a notice of the intent to revoke the clinic's license. And obviously, you know, we want the clinic to stay open and to be able to continue providing quality health care to the women of Mississippi.
And so do you think that it would be just another round of challenges to the law, or is that just not a possibility now?
I think it's still a possibility. I mean, the judge's order really turned on the fact that there was no immediate harm to the clinic because of this administrative process that needed to play out. And so once the administrative process is concluded, and once it's clear that the hospitals aren't going to grant privileges or haven't granted privileges or just, you know, aren't acting, I think that would change things quite a bit for the judge. But, you know, who knows? Certainly we would make our arguments and he'll make his ruling.
So we are not going to know much about their fate for, what, 6 months at least?
I'm not actually sure they'll even get the 6 months, you know. I mean, it's a discretionary determination on the Department of Health part. So at this point, there's a lot up in the air.
Awesome. Well, thank you for bringing us up to date, Michelle. My guest today has been Michelle Movahead from the Center for Reproductive Rights. You can learn more about this case and others like it by going to reproductiverights.org. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Michelle.
Thanks so much, Amanda.
There's a lot of places where I expect to get concern trolled for no other reason than I'm a lady. You get accustomed, when you're female, to having people put on a concerned face so they can insinuate that being female means you're stupid or that they can butt into your business, especially with regards to your sexual or reproductive choices. I expect it at family-oriented gatherings, the internet, places like that, but not in bars. Not that bars are some kind of wonderland without problems, but one that they're usually free of is of people trying to make you feel like you're nothing more than a two-legged life support system for a uterus, and to express a feigned concern that your stupid lady brain is conflicting with your soul function as a baby factory. Bars, by virtue of being a place for adults to congregate, are usually free, by and large, of the pregnancy and childbirth obsession in our culture, and of using that obsession to bully women and make them feel like they're bad for all their non-baby-making related behaviors. But now there's pressure to change all that, starting with a bar in Minneapolis.
Out of all his expectations for his business, the owner of Pub 500 never envisioned himself...
Strange. Yes.
...as the proprietor of a pregnancy test.
There's a bar in Mankato that's putting a pregnancy test in. Why?
This bathroom vending machine is the vision of a regular customer, Jody Allen Crow.
It's focused on prevention.
Great. So this bar wants to be the testing grounds for a widespread expansion of the uterine contents police state. Naturally, it's not just the bar owner who approved this who is a man, but also the guy who asked to have the pregnancy test machine put in. I say naturally because they seem to have a poor idea of how the actual process of learning you're pregnant goes. As a person with a uterus, I can assure you that it's not really related to the bar going experience in any way. The fact that the vending machine piously recommends women pregnancy test every 2 weeks really drives home how little these guys know about how women's bodies actually work. But of course, a lot of this is exploiting anxieties about women drinking alcohol. The possibility of pregnancy just gives that urge to moralize a form and an excuse.
He's also an expert in fetal alcohol spectrum disorder and runs the organization Healthy Brains for Children. He shows us, with the swipe of a debit card, women can buy a pregnancy test for $3.
If it gives you an informed decision at that point in time to stop drinking, your baby's going to be better for it.
Lately, when I hear the words informed choice being tossed around regarding pregnancy, I grab my wallet. Informed decision-making is a great thing, but the phrase has been co-opted by misogynist elements, such as crisis pregnancy centers, to imply that women are really stupid and can't make a good decision without having someone, preferably an older white man, holding her hand and exerting pressure. What we know is that these things escalate. The first ultrasound laws justified with this informed decision rationale just required doctors to offer the option of an ultrasound. Now you have to have the ultrasound and have to listen to a badgering script and have to hear the heartbeat and have to endure a vaginal probe, which is why all this makes me uneasy. Right now it's being introduced as a soft thing, like, oh, we're just giving you totally voluntary option to just know, all up to you. But the groundwork being laid here could be used to create a situation where women feel that they have to go through a humiliating process of peeing on a stick to order a bar. Ugh. But the groundwork being laid here could be used to create a situation where women feel that they have to go through a humiliating process of peeing on a stick to do something as simple as order a drink in a bar. I suspect the reporters doing this soft, feel-good story may have suspected that the whole thing isn't as sunshine and rainbows as they're pretending, if only because the whole thing is a matter of two men exerting pressure on women to feel we have to pregnancy test before every damn drink that we have. So, in order to make the whole thing feel less creepy and intrusive, they got some women on tape supporting it. But I am not fooled.
It's actually a really good idea. Less embarrassing than going to the drugstore. You know, it's discreet, it's readily available, they're inexpensive.
The discreet thing is particularly thoughtless. Few places are more discreet than a bar bathroom. Drugstores are way more discreet. Plus, I can't think of a worse place to go through the stress of pregnancy testing than a friggin' bar. That's an occasion where both you and the people around you need to be clear-headed and serious, not goofing off and getting tipsy. To make things even more alarming, a not insignificant number of couples going to bars are involved in abusive relationships. I can't think of a more combustible combination than an abusive man, alcohol, and a pregnancy test, especially a positive one. Fetal alcohol syndrome is a real problem, but treating women like morons and increasing the uterus surveillance isn't the answer. The real answer is better access to birth control and better access to substance abuse resources so women can choose to get pregnant when they feel capable of being sober during their pregnancies. And now for the wisdom of Wingnuts. At least they're getting more upfront about it, edition. Cal Biesner of the Cornwall Alliance was on Brian Fisher's radio program, and they got to talking about Pixar's new girl-centered movie, Brave. I'm sure you'll be shocked to know that they strongly disapprove of girls having movies where they get to be real protagonists instead of passive princesses.
Brave. It's a movie set in Scotland. It's a, it's a cartoon. And this movie attacks marriage and undermines the human desire to procreate, to multiply, as God meant us to do. And in it, a young princess in Scotland just refuses to get married. She'll do anything she can to stay out of it. And she even goes to a witch to have a spell cast on the queen, her own mother.
Of course, if you get to see the movie, you know she never says she's against marriage. She just doesn't want to be sold by her father to a prince who won her in a contest. So I guess if you're against arranged marriage, you're anti-procreation and anti-marriage generally. Good to know.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly key newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.